or the transition from placer to hard rock.
Yes.
You may not be ready for this comment yet, but it was Steve Masterman. Steve Masterman did his master's thesis on some structural stuff in the Circle District and found something they called the Porcupine Anticline. And it is a great big anticlinarium off the Tintina Fault. The Tintina Fault going, of course, right through Central. And you can see you come down these bluffs and it's there.
Just in front of Hot Springs.
Yeah, well, but you see, if you're driving from Central back to town, you'll be coming through the flats, and then you see this ridge that comes down, and that cuts that cross to and gets cut off at the Tintina Fault. Another paper that was, I'd say in the same, was a little earlier, was Jim Barker's, when he was first with the Bureau of Mines. And it's a very fascinating picture that he had drawn. And it was the fault again. But he had transitioned the land so that you could see that Woodchopper, Ketchum, and all of the creeks from Circle District hooked up to those that were over, or Woodchopper, and those hooked up to the ones that were in coming out of Central, Deadwood, Ketchum, etc. It was just a slight turn, curvature, and slip.
Mm-hmm.
And those creeks all lined up. Somewhere, I think, I've still got a picture of that. It was quite inspirational to me. When we first got there, of course, we were placer-oriented.
When was that?
64.
Uh-huh.
1964. We met Mr. McGee. El McGee, the one that was up at Indian Mountain, down at Hope, over at Tofty, the one that founded Alaska Airlines, which became was McGee Airways, then it became Star, then it became Alaska. He was a real... He said he got to Alaska 20 years too late. He missed it. But he was an old-timer by the time I met him. And he had a foot all through this country. When he was a young man and broke, he ran booze on up the sea. Booze to Canada and furs back. Right on the rivers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So he had property?
Oh yeah, he had drilled at Porcupine Creek in the Circle District. But he had waited 20 years for water rights over in the Tofty area. Somebody had the water rights and he couldn't get any water to do that bench at Tofty on Sullivan Creek, Cache Creek. And so he had drilled Porcupine, and gold was 35. I mean, the area was pretty stagnant. I think there were three, maybe four people mining. Walter Roman was still mining. I know he had a big season that year. It's the first time I ever met him. And people on 2nd Avenue, where he'd been in to see Harry Abercroft, the old jeweler. And Walter went in and he came out and someone told him, oh, I heard you had a wonderful season that you took out over $100,000. And he said, it would have been a wonderful season if it hadn't cost me $110,000 to do it. Those are good memories.
Yeah. So how come you decided to come into it and do that?
Well, we were in... My mother and stepfather had been up to look at a property on Miller Creek.
Oh.
They knew someone from Oregon who was trying to work with Fred Wilkinson's family. And Mother was pretty impressed with it. And this guy said that he had a lease on Porcupine Creek. And that there were drill logs. Well, Henry's family had been miners. His grandfather had been a hard rock miner from Wales who went to Mexico to work in one of the big silver load mines, to run it. And he had married, and so Henry's father was half Spanish American and Welsh, and Henry was 1/4. So that's fine. So mining came, you know, it did not seem out of place to him. Mining was certainly not out of place to me. I had 49ers in my family who came over Immigrant Gap and found gold in, I think it was Amador County in 1849, and bought 1,000 acres in the sand. They made so much money. Can you imagine in that era when people, that he came out in the spring to California and found gold and was able to send 250, we've got an old journal that's in the museum down in California, and there's this journal, it talks about, and he sent $252 cash money to his wife and two children and the family in Illinois, and told his brother to bring both families west. But that was a huge amount of money then. Plus he bought 1,000 acres. So mining came intuitively in my family. The Bonson collection that's in the San Francisco Academy of Science, mineral collection. Bonson was a grandfather. So that, it's really not so strange we gave up what we were doing. It's kind of like it's in the genes. Mm-hmm. I was working at the Lawrence Radiation Labs in radiochemistry, and Henry was principal research technician in chemistry. And Mother mentioned this man who had a lease with a drill log. Well, of course, being a little bit suspicious, or cautious would be a better word. I don't have much conspiracy theory in me. More cautious. Prudent. We decided to call the man who, we tried to get hold of the man who said he had the lease and theoretically had the drill log. And we got hold of him, but he didn't have the drill log, but he would get it. Well, he didn't get it. You know, about 6 weeks went by and there was no action. So we called the man who owned the drill log, who was El McGee, and he was wintering on Virginia Lake out of Reno with his wife Helen. And we drove up to Reno to meet him and to get a copy of the drill log, or to look at the drill log. And we're quite shocked when we introduced ourselves at the tour and said something about this Mr. Carr who had a lease. And he said, I didn't know Mr. Carr had a lease, but come on in, let's talk business. Mm-hmm. He handed us the drill log and a book on placer mining in Alaska. We had the drill log evaluated by Alan Probert, who had been an evaluating engineer for the USSR and M Company for the dredges. And his comment was, if I were 20 years younger, I'd be calling Mr. McGee. Mm. You know, if you're going to take a chance, you couldn't do better. So that was the Circle District, and it was a placer district. There'd been one hard rock claim in the district, way back in about 1938. I think it was the year I was born, and I've got a copy of the claim notice. you're going to know who it is, and I'm going to have a mental. He was not down at Denali. They burned his
uncle.
No, the other one, the one that his calf was burned down, his mine site. He was around here forever, and I'm sure it begins with a P. Park Service burned it accidentally.
You talking about Kentishna area?
Yes.
Some of those I don't know.
I'll think of it before we're done, and if I don't, I'll refresh it. I'll get you a note because I know it. But he was out in the Circle District. I staked one Hard Rock claim, and it was on the kind of, there's Ptarmigan Creek coming up from mile 101, and then there's Porcupine Dome, and there's kind of a saddle deal in there, and it was on the east flank of Porcupine Dome. So that was the only Hard Rock claims in the Circle District prior to the, I think the first ones were NERCO's. No, we had some. NERCO had some. After the AMRAP reports, remember that we had the great withdrawals of the Carter era, there was big to-do from the mining community that they hadn't done proper mineral evaluations before withdrawing the lands. And there was an interest in at least studying, it might never change the withdrawal, but we're going to study it. And the USGS did a big project after Helen Foster and Helen and Florence Weber. I remember that one. And Helen Foster did a lot of structural work on that. So they did some really serious, big USGS stuff. And Paul Mitz brought the geologic students at their summer camp out in the district doing field survey. Jim Barker had, at the Bureau of Mines had taken an interest in surveying and seeing what was there. And that had been early in his career. He'd run, particularly I think Karen Plotis even worked on that project. They ran soil seds, panned all the streams, ran soil seds, good survey stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the first sparks of interest in Hard Rock had come with a little hope that maybe there'd be an antimony. I think in World War II they got some antimony samples.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody followed up with any claims because they couldn't find anything to mine. But they had seen, people had seen rocks. I do see references in Murdy reports or other reports about seeing small veinlets in the placers or rocks that were coming out that were more rock than nugget. It wasn't that people weren't interested, but with the, and it's not hugely deep overburden, but it's discontinuous permafrost, and it's got a lot of coverage. It, we don't have a lot of exposures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the cost of operating out there. There's no infrastructure. The price of gold when I went out there was $35 an ounce. And you couldn't, even in Fairbanks area district where there were roads and it had been a very big established placer district, and there had been the McCartney and the Better Boys, and people had mined successfully over in Esther. They'd had some Hard Rock at the Grand and at the Bartholomew. But you had to, even close to town, you had to have at least $80 an ounce. And that was close to 3 ounces a ton. And we don't see much 3 ounce a ton ore. Don't need that anymore. 0.04, and people don't turn their nose up, they look.
Yeah.
Because if there's enough of it, they can do something.
So you started, when you came up, you actually went over the ground then?
Oh, yes.
On Porcupine.
Yes, we dug holes.
Oh.
And the first season, we didn't have any equipment. We had totally old-fashioned manual labor. But we dug and we panned and we looked. There was a nice little camp there. And so Dennis Mcgee came over from Tofty. He was over setting up his Tofty operation. And he came over and he was pulling some pipe. He said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Well, we want to talk about the land. We want the land. We want to get a lease." And that was almost the end of our career, because he said, "If it's worth leasing, it's worth buying."
Mm.
And of course, we didn't have any money. I think we had $756. And a full cap of groceries and stuff, but 756 cash dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like something out of the Dust Bowl days heading for California.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't quite that bad. And he must have known that, because he said, "Meet me at the Nordale in town next Monday." And so we came to town and met him. And he said, "Well, you're going to buy it. What do you think about $750 down?"
Uh-huh.
"And I'll throw in a quart of Valentine scotch." And so I wrote a check. Henry and I looked at each other. I don't know what we were going to do with $6 left, but we wrote a check. And we never looked back.
Mm.
There were times when the creek owed us money. There were times when we owed it money, but that was just
About how old were you guys?
I was 20. Let's see, that's 64. I was 26, and Henry was 31. Old enough to know better, but young enough to still do it.
So were things pretty active in, I mean, around?
No, there was no activity.
No.
There was Miller House. As I say, Walter Roman was mining, but moving. He was moving over to Fish Creek. In fact, he was in the process of moving, because Henry helped him move the big drag line over. Freddie Wilkinson hadn't come back to Miller Creek yet. He came back in about six, I've forgotten what year it was. It wasn't long after. Frank and Vi Pierce were running the little store in Central. Frank and Graciela Miller were at Miller House. The legend of the highway department, Elmer Parkinson, was made head of the road crew. And Doc Zurich, who was a doctor from Germany, who was out there, fixed the D8s, etc., ran ran out of equipment on the road crew and took care of all the people too. And your cats and your dogs and anything else. So we had a doctor. John, the hot springs was active, and people did come out to the hot springs. People came out, I mean, it was touristy, if anything, and it was on the road to Circle City, which was the only place you could see the Yukon in those days. It was the only road to the Yukon.
I can't imagine driving out that old highway, that old road out that way, and striking off the Porcupine Creek. Wow.
I had to walk it the first time. 11 miles. Well, the first day we walked in about 6 miles and came back and decided that we could drive 6 miles, but we knew we couldn't drive back 6. We drove for a tried 6 the next time and had to walk still 12 miles.
Wow.
I can remember, I call it Mythical Porcupine Hill. We got there. That was one more hill to climb, and it was about 5 miles of hiking up. And I looked at Henry and I said, I don't believe there is a Porcupine Creek camp. And he said, nobody would build a road in this country unless it went somewhere.
Pragmatist, yes.
Yes. Well, we were in camp about a half hour later.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So were you ready for this? I mean, were your legs in shape?
Heaven forbid, no. I've been wearing 4-inch heels and mini skirts. I've been working in San Francisco. I had blood blisters by the time I walked in, and I still had to walk back out.
Wow. And your equipment, did it take a while then?
Acquired? Oh, yes. One little piece at a time. We were not well funded. It took 2 good jobs to support one placer mine. And then in 68, of course, after Bretton Woods, the lid on the price of gold was off.
Yes.
And it didn't go wild. I think it went up to about 48 to begin with, and then 68. But you didn't have to sell it to the mint anymore either. And that made a big difference.
Did you start seeing more activity around the district then?
No, it didn't really start moving. Things were getting better. Remember the roads, all this infrastructure was going on too, mm-hmm. but the North Slope was the big thing right then, those early years. 60, we were working for R&M in the winter and then going out to the camp in the summer. But those years from 68 to about 74 were very much dominated by the Pipeline North. But that made money available for buying equipment. And as I say, remember, we had drill logs. And we were on a traditional creek that we knew something about after Mrs. Miller told us she was the postmistress. She'd shipped all of the... I'm glad you can organize things, because I just leave out things, and then I think, oh, she shipped all of the Dutch kid's gold from his years that he was working up there. He had a crew. He had one of the first cats in the district. Tractors. Caterpillar tractor. And it didn't even have a blade on it. It was only used for moving hydraulic equipment around pumps. And he pull graded with it. He had a pull grader. It didn't have a blade. And he was a hydraulic miner. And he was had a lease from the people named Reed, who had the property. And then Mr. and Mrs. Reed got a divorce, and Mrs. Reed married the Dutch kid. And then Mr. Reed wanted to double the royalty. He wanted as much royalty as what he'd had to divide it with his wife, because she always collected her half of the cleanup also. And the Dutch kid said, no, I've taken on half your overhead. So he mined out what he had, and he left and went to Rampart. And his name was actually Albert Martin. And it was 1938 that Heine Karstein was up there working for him.
And so you had good information about the creek.
Mrs. Miller had shipped all the gold that they produced through the post office there at Miller House. So she could tell me approximately what kind of years they had, how much gold they were producing, and that was a very interesting. It made you sure that there was something there.
Yes.
Because we certainly didn't know anything about mining. But the first year that we sluiced, we barreled everything out of the sluice box. Well, Mr. Miller, at Miller House, first of all, made us some paddles so that we could paddle the box. And then we barreled up all of our cons and took them up to the School of Mines because we didn't have any fines. We just didn't have any. We didn't have anything under 40 mesh. Anything significant. We had nuggets. We had gold, but we did not have any fines. So Ernie Wolf, Lonnie Heiner. Lonnie was a grad student then. I was a grad student then. Fred Hankinson and Jimmy Wallace. And the rest of the students, those were the grad students, and the rest, all came out to Porcupine to dig and look and find our finds.
Mm.
Because they went through everything in our barrels, and we amalgamated up there with their little ball mill. And at the end of a couple of days up there, it was concluded we didn't have fines. Nobody could find any fines. But everybody could find some gold. Now that was not significant at the time. It was just don't worry about it. If you don't have when you're getting enough, don't worry about it. But it became significant recently. You know, 35, 40 years later. Because it seems we're close to the source. It is looking like Porcupine, one of the models put out by USGS, I believe it was either Yend or Trip. Somehow I think it was Yend said that he thought that the Porcupine Creek area, the dome, was the source of all the gold in the Circle District.
Hmm.
And Tripp did another kind of evaluation. These are two USGSers mm-hmm. from Denver. I'm not. I'm putting it on the record as all. And Tripp had done this map and divided Circle District into four or five sections and said that the section that Porcupine Creek was in, or Porcupine Dome, was the most likely source of gold for the district. And he found a roadside occurrence that was interesting. Now this is concurring in time with the same time Steve Masterman comes up with the structural and a planorium and does his master's thesis on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see about early 80s And the price of gold has now hit, you know, the placer price. Well, for us it was placer. The price of gold had hit 800. There was an increasing interest in finding gold. And what used to be a 3 ounce and a ton problem, even with inflation, was no longer a 3 ounce a ton problem. It was an ounce a ton would look awfully good. Mm-hmm. A half ounce a ton, if you had any tonnage, could look really good. So you see a transition there. And then, of course, after the 80s, the placers were hit hard in the 80s. There, at one time, there were between six and 800, nobody ever had a full, definite count, individual operations in the Circle District during the period from about 78 to 81, 82. In there. I mean, it started to swell up, peaked, and then fell off slowly. But this meant that the placers were also getting worked out. Because these placers weren't being hit by the old bomb-pa hand methods. People were rolling, they started with military surplus eights, and they were rolling out there with D9Ls and stuff before it was over D10s. I mean, it's relatively shallow placers, wouldn't support dredges. I mean, it takes a lot of yardage to support a dredge. Gravel. And these placers are substantially bedrock placers. Mm. Now, there had been a dredge on Mastodon Creek, the O'Berry Company dredge, and it had dredged Mastodon down to Bedrock Creek. In fact, that's where the dredge had ended up. But it hadn't operated for years. And then there had been a dredge on Deadwood Creek that Murdy's wrote about, and it got moved to Gnome Creek. And its problem on Deadwood was that the bedrock was so wavy and so hard that the dredge couldn't recover the gold. So even for dredging fields, things can be interesting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now there's a possibility at this price. Currently, I think there's a big, I've heard, I haven't seen it yet, but it would not surprise me. I know two young men who have held a substantial number of claims out there on Crooked Creek, a lot of them. And I hear they're drilling, and that would be Carl Hahnemann and John Birdland, maybe. Maybe drilling. I know they've kept the ground for years, and I see Nancy every once in a while that I have lunch, but we don't usually talk about who's doing what. Mm-hmm. We gossip too much.
Well, I think this is about finished.